of the day, United States versus Cooper. Mr. Mitchell.
Please, the court. Gregory T. Mitchell, on behalf of Mr. Cortez Cooper, is the appellant, the government. Your Honors, this case and this appeal primarily deals with one issue, and that's sentencing. Understanding, Judge, that 21-851 involves pretrial charging decisions by the government, but the facts of this case clearly points out that the only issue in regards to this defendant and the government. Well, what was the appropriate sentence that the government was deciding given this individual's conduct? What is missing, Judge, with respect to the government's response brief, but it mentions very slightly, is that Mr. Cooper, after he was arrested, came in and proffered. He signed a proffer agreement represented by a different attorney. And given that, the issue was, what was an appropriate sentence given what the government knew at the time that he was involved in and what information he could provide for them to help the other co-conspirators, which were many. What happened at that proffer hearing, Judge? What happened in that session? Mr. Cooper, represented by counsel, told the government things the government did not know. And based upon that, Mr. Cooper's involvement exploded from the government's perspective. They began to see that he was a much bigger player than they first decided. But this information was learned pursuant to a proffer protection with an attorney. Notwithstanding that, when Mr. Cooper was finally charged by indictment, he was now charged with a conspiracy that expanded 10 years or so, none of which his involvement was revealed part of the investigation, but came from his cooperation. The question became, what would be the appropriate sentence for Mr. Cooper, given the cooperation and what the government has now learned about his involvement with the co-conspirators? And the government came up with a number. And they came up with a number, and they offered it as part of the plea agreement. What happened at that point, Judge, is the real key in this case. Can the government then manipulate their charging decision to, in fact, get the sentence that they determined was most appropriate in the case? Now, I've looked through the case law, Judge, and we tried to figure it all out as to what is the power of the government. And clearly, the government has a duty to notify the defendant what type of sentence it may be seeking, given the fact of the conduct that he's been charged with. But what about the inverse? Can the government essentially decide to make a charging decision to get the sentence that it has already determined it has determines is the most appropriate for this defendant because of information that it has learned? When that happened, what did Mr. Cooper do? He fired his first attorney. He said, no, I thought we had an agreement. What I told the government would not be used against me as a charging decision or an aggravation. But in effect, that's what occurred. He got a second attorney. The second attorney said, look, it doesn't really matter. This is what the offer is, and it's a good offer, given what they know about you and your involvement. Mr. Cooper argued, but they didn't know about that involvement. They never charged me with that involvement until I came in and proffered. That attorney said, we have no recourse, because essentially this is a pre-indictment decision. The 851 that they could file against you would make your sentence even worse. That attorney was relieved as well. Attorney number three comes in, and that is me. And the argument is that, wait a minute, what involves here is what is the power of the government to manipulate the sentencing by manipulating the charging decision? And the way the government does it, this court has addressed several times. You don't charge a minor offense and then use the relevant conduct and the sentencing guidelines to thereby enhance the sentence two and threefold to get the sentence that you want. You be very careful with your charging decision. The government, in fact, was careful. They charged a particular conspiracy, and they charged the conduct that they knew that Mr. Cooper was involved in. There was a problem, though, with the conspiracy charge. The conspiracy charge that was now alleged with Mr. Cooper expanded in a period of almost 15 years, involving conduct that Mr. Cooper told the government in terms of his proffer. So, of course, in pretrial motions, now that Mr. Cooper refused to accept the deal, those were the pretrial motions that were filed. And, in fact, the conspiracy was eventually narrowed down. The conspiracy charge was narrowed down. Mr. Cooper, however, would not agree to plead to the conspiracy charge. What he agreed to plead to is what, in fact, the government had already knew when he came in to proffer and what the charge was going to be. And he pled guilty to that. So this case was never about a pre-charging decision. What happened at that point, Judge, is that the government, some 15 months later, said, listen, if you do not plead to this wide-ranging conspiracy that I now know you are involved in, that I learned from you, as you said in my office under proffer, I am going to file what I have a right to file, at 851 sentencing enhancement. That is a heavy hammer. No question about it. Mr. Cooper was aware. This attorney received it, and he was notified that, in fact, if you plead to these charges and the government proves in relevant conduct at a sentencing hearing, you are subject to a 20-year sentence. Mr. Cooper understood that. He pled to the two charges, and the government had a choice to make. The government could have gone to trial on the conspiracy charge that was already there and thereby had a sentencing hearing to include that 851 notification, or they could have argued what this court has warned them and cautioned them not to do. Do not go forward with this minor charge and try to bring in your sentencing at the sentencing hearing with relevant conduct. The government chose the second approach. Why? Because it was easier. Different standard, rules of evidence, nothing. Essentially, a trial about the sentence, which had been argued for 15 months. And Judge Manning said, no, the Seventh Circuit has cautioned you against that. I am not going to enhance this defendant's sentence based on this evidence that was learned from the defendant himself at the proffer without a conviction for the conspiracy charge, which would have enhanced his sentencing range. And that ruling was there. At that point, Judge Manning issued the sentence pursuant to the guidelines and then enhanced Mr. Cooper's sentence pursuant to 21A51. So he essentially went from a 7-year sentence to 10 years because of the enhancement. The government, again, had a choice to make, and it was made clear on the record. You don't get two bites at the apple. The government either could have appealed Judge Manning's decision at that point to find that her decision for relevant conduct was an error with the evidence, was against the manifest weight, an abuse of discretion, but they chose not to. Instead, they decided to add additional charges with a mandatory 5-year sentence, charges that they clearly knew about some 2 years before. They also decided to change the indictment, change the conspiracy, and now we have a superseding indictment in which he is now going to trial after he has been sentenced. Now, the government makes a long approach with respect to this reliance on Williams. And they even remark in their case that Williams is remarkably like this case. Your Honors, Williams is absolutely nothing like this case. Williams that they cite is the second Williams case. Williams 1, essentially, was involving three defendants where the sentence that were imposed after they had gone to trial, there were no proffers, there was no cooperation, there was nothing. In fact, in that case, there was an informant that clearly involved all defendants. Mr. Williams got 264 months. The other defendants got life in 30 years. The 851 in that regard were over the top. What Williams argued on number one is that, well, 851 was unconstitutional because I don't have a chance to argue for habeas to show that conviction shouldn't be used. That's not what's here. Second of all, in Williams number one, when the case was reversed, completely vacated, he was not already pending under a sentence. His sentence had been vacated. So when he was tried a second time with a superseding indictment, there was no sentence that was being added to, aggregated in that regard. That's not what happened here. The government had a sentence that it just didn't like. And I believe the record indicates that the comment was it was whack. The judge basically had just missed the key. The bottom line here, Judge, is that 851 is not designed to simply be used as a hammer
unless, of course, that's in terms of the first sentencing hearing. And that's what happened in this case. If the government decided to supersede, start over again, add new charges that they could have had, the argument is either twofold. Number one, they had to use another conviction. Or number two, they have to at least refile another one to show that somehow this new sentencing hearing is going to aggregate it a second time. Our argument is sort of, it's double jeopardy again. First, we had to fight the government at the relevant conduct trial at the sentencing hearing, which is from the very beginning. And when you lost, we have to fight the government again now at the second hearing, even though you haven't even filed the notice. And what the government wants to say is that it just simply carries through. We can have the judge do it twice. And because there's been no Seventh Circuit law, and in fact, hardly any law, the 11th Circuit is pretty much the only circuit has dealt with it, but it's always in a pretrial setting, a mistrial setting, or a superseding indictment, not with two sentencing hearings. I see my time is up, and unless there's any questions, Judge, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Mr. Hook, Mr. Sussman.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, Eric Sussman for the United States. Let me first respond to some of the facts that were set forth to Your Honors. First of all, it was brought up, and this is in the record, that Mr. Cooper did come in shortly after his arrest, probably several months after his arrest, to proffer. He gave a proffer statement to the government, and to say he came in is probably misstates the record. We actually went out to Dodge County. I was the prosecutor who went out there. We went out to Dodge County. We took a proffer of Mr. Cooper with his lawyer. Mr. Cooper attempted to cooperate. This was all in the record before the district court. In fact, there was an argument very similar to the one that was made by Mr. Mitchell, a factual argument that was made in Mr. Cooper's first sentencing, which was back in January 20th of 04 and is in the record. The argument, again, that was made is at that sentencing hearing before Judge Manning is, Judge, the government is relying on has violated the proffer agreement. The government's relying on proffer protected information both to indict Mr. Cooper as well as to enhance his sentence. Judge Manning heard testimony. Judge Manning considered that issue, and I'll quote from Judge Manning's opinion, which is attached as Supplement A-12 to the defendant's or to the appellant's brief. The judge stated, at the sentencing hearing, the government unequivocally stated that neither the United States Attorney's Office nor the FBI revealed the contents of Cooper's proffer to any witnesses, including Rogers, one of the government's main cooperating witnesses, including the government contends that Rogers' statements implicating Cooper were the result of independent investigation. Because the court has no reason to disbelieve the veracity of this statement, the court will not ignore the other relevant conduct evidence in the PSR. So, actually, if Your Honor goes to that transcript of that sentencing hearing, you'll see that an agent was called to rebut that allegation that the government had in some way used the proffer protected information to enhance Mr. Cooper or to charge him or try to sentence him. Beside the fact that the government, as we pointed out, would be perfectly entitled to use leads, investigative leads, that came up from that proffer, the fact of the matter is that when Mr. Cooper was arrested on a complaint, it was a broad-reaching conspiracy complaint based on Title III recordings. So there was ample evidence against Mr. Cooper, including the testimony of the main drug dealer in that case, Hugh Rogers, whose telephone was being wiretapped. So, and Mr. Rogers was cooperating. The way it's being portrayed to the court is that the government came up with a number that it thought that Mr. Cooper should take, and the government was bound and determined to get that number no matter what. That is, on some level, only really a partial truth, and let me explain what I mean. Mr. Cooper came in, he proffered. By this point in time, or shortly after Mr. Cooper proffered, the main defendant in this case had proffered. It was roughly a 12-defendant drug case. The main defendant had proffered, the main defendant had testified in the grand jury, the main defendant had pled guilty. So, quite frankly, Mr. Cooper was not needed. He really wasn't needed by the government at this point in time. Nevertheless, the government had made an offer for a cooperation deal to Mr. Cooper. The government stood by that offer. It was roughly 12 years. And I don't think there's anything in the record to suggest, and I know this came up several times before Judge Manning, that the government did everything it could, as did some of Mr. Cooper's former lawyers, and I think even Mr. Cooper's current lawyer, to get Mr. Cooper to take the deal that was on the table for 12 years. Because ultimately what he was facing was a sentence of 360 months to life, 30 years to life. Mr. Cooper simply didn't want to do the time. It was quite frankly as simple as that. Mr. Cooper attempted to plead to a portion of the indictment in the hopes that maybe the government wouldn't bother to go to trial on him with a conspiracy. The government exercised its rights to go to trial on the conspiracy to force him to either accept responsibility or be found guilty by a jury of the full conspiracy. We went to trial, and prior to going to trial, we filed a Section 851 enhancement on both Mr. Cooper and his co-defendant, not just Mr. Cooper. Mr. Cooper and his co-defendant, Mr. Cooper was well aware, and I don't think it's an issue here, that he received that 851 enhancement. He had notice of that 851 enhancement. Mr. Cooper was sentenced initially on the counts that he had pled guilty to, which were two of the substantive counts. Mr. Cooper faced a sentence of roughly a guideline sentence, as Judge Manning calculated it, of roughly 70 to 87 months. Judge Manning enhanced his sentence to 120 months based on the earlier filed notice of enhancement. So Mr. Cooper had already been sentenced and enhanced once, knew it was coming again. The government and Mr. Cooper, there's engaged in additional discussions to try to encourage Mr. Cooper or to see if there was a way to resolve the case short of going to trial. Mr. Cooper didn't like the fact that the enhancement had been filed and the government was not willing to withdraw it at that point in time. Mr. Cooper elected to go to trial. He was found guilty, and he was sentenced ultimately to the mandatory minimum, which was 20 years in prison based on the enhancement. So I don't think there's been much by way of additional information that's been brought to this court to suggest that there was anything either improper in the government's filing of the 851 enhancement or in the government's motivation behind the prosecution and behind the filing of the 851. I did supplement the record with this court's recent decision in Jarrett, which talks about the very high standard pretrial for prosecutorial vindictiveness. And I'll rely on our briefs with respect to the law on being able to ignore statutory minimums, which I don't think there's any argument the district court cannot do. And unless there are any further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the decision.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mitchell, your time has expired, but you may have a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I would just like to comment on the recent case in Jarrett and ask the court. In Jarrett, the court acknowledged that there's two separate standards. There's a very high standard where you have to have subjective and direct evidence of prosecutorial vindictiveness at pretrial. But there is inferences that can be drawn, and I think the Falcone case with the dissent from Judge Williams indicated that there can be the presumption because of the circumstances. This is a case, Judge, where this happened after a guilty plea, after a sentencing, and subsequent to a superseding indictment thereby. It's clearly not pretrial. And whether or not the lesser standard should be applied with respect to this case, we would argue that Jarrett, in fact, should be applied, and that lesser standard, and there's enough inferences in this record that will support a finding in that regard. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Thanks, all counsel. Mr. Mitchell, I want to extend an extra special thanks for your accepting this appointment and so ably representing the defendant.
Thank you, Your Honor.